Hillary Clinton and strategies for breaking glass ceilings of your own. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Hillary Clinton's video appearance on the convention big screen last night opened with digitized glass shattering, with her campaign's producers well aware of the symbolism of the glass ceiling for women shattering at the highest level of U.S. politics. The focal length widened then to show Clinton with some girls at her side.
If there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next. Thank you all. I can't wait to join you in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Let's put this into a wider context with two expert views. First, the Harvard Business School's Rosabeth Moss Kanter, who's a noted expert on leadership and management informed by her sociology background. We reached her in Philadelphia where she's attending the convention. Dr. Kanter, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, that was a loud crack in the glass ceiling last night, with Hillary Clinton becoming the first female presidential nominee from a major political party in the U.S.?
Yes, I think it's fabulous. And it seemed to me less a glass ceiling now than a sunroof, where we can pull it back, see the sunshine, and feel hope.
Well, I take your metaphor there. But because this ultimate glass ceiling could shatter in November, does this mean anything for the other glass ceilings that women face in their careers?
I think it does. It is clear that having a woman prime minister doesn't necessarily mean that every woman in the workplace suddenly faces equal opportunity and the end of harassment and so forth. But it provides more motivation, more inspiration, more sense that if she can do it, and against the odds that she has faced, then maybe it's worth persisting rather than dropping out.
Now, you've thought and written about these issues. As organizations try to think about ways that the best people move to the top, they have to address this issue of gender bias.
Oh, they definitely do, because the evidence shows that the companies that have addressed it do better. And it may not be because they have more women. It may be because they have more open cultures. But I think the next steps will also be things that nominee Clinton will undertake, which is questions of family. How do we help people balance or integrate the fact that they have families to care for? And women bear a disproportionate share of the responsibilities for children, but also for elder care, which is a growing issue. The fact that she could be in the White House, and assuming that she does get to the White House, I am sure that issues of family leave and caretaking leave will be addressed. And until we make those valuable assets for society, then we won't really change the situation for women enough.
The Harvard Business School's Rosabeth Moss Kanter contributed some policy proposals to the Clinton campaign and was an economic advisor to Michael Dukakis when he ran for president in 1988. Dr. Kanter, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Also in Philadelphia, let's bring in Nancy Rothbard, professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, who notes there's still another glass ceiling to break even for the nominee.
It's still not fully broken. First of all, you have to win to break it. But secondly, in other arenas of American life, this is still a very prevalent problem. When we look at the business world, for example, there are a lot of women who have entered the workforce at the lower levels of the organization, as well as starting to be in the managerial levels of the organization. But once you start to get up into the upper echelons, which are really the kind of very high level vice president and director roles, then you really start to see fewer and fewer women.
Well, it's almost a parallel with the Hillary Clinton example, right? Because you think of Mary Barra at General Motors, you think of IBM. These may be examples that don't tell the wider story.
Absolutely. So there are examples, as you say, of women in these roles, but they're not so prevalent. And when you look at the statistics, it's actually quite challenging problem, because these numbers have been there for a few years now. And I think initially people were thinking, oh, this is going to really change and we've broken through. But in fact, the numbers have plateaued in recent years.
So for larger organizations, smaller organizations that want the best people at the top that will include women, What is some of the state-of-the-art thinking about changing this persistent cultural feature of women not getting to the top?
Unfortunately, we don't have great solutions. One of the thoughts in recent years has been that we really need to encourage sponsorship of women. And sponsors are people who, additionally, will advocate for you, who are there to say, you know, this person is going to be a star, and we really need to develop this person. And so they need to put their thumb on the scale for you and really try to help get you the opportunities that will put you on that path.
You're not just talking about this in this interview. You're living it. There's the news that you're the first woman chair of the management department at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes. I was July 1. I became the first woman chair of the management department, which, thank you, which is the one of the largest departments at Wharton. And people have noted this. It's not that it's gone unnoticed. It's been very salient to many people. It's very, well, because I'm the first. It's unusual. It's been a very long time. The Wharton School has been around since the 1880s.
Dr. Rothbard, did you have a mentor keeping an eye out along with you?
So I did. And I had more than one. And I had both male and female mentors and sponsors along the way. And I think that was absolutely important for me in my career. And I think it will continue to be important.
Nancy Rothbard is the new chair of the management department at the Wharton School. Dr. Rothbard, thank you for this.
Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Later this week, Shell and Exxon report profits. But for now, a big question lingers. Where will wobbly oil prices go next? It's a matter of global demand and supply, of course, plus an important factor of how much oil is being stored, which requires a bit of industry sleuthing, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
For more than a year, the world has been working off an oil glut. And now some of that glut has gone into storage, caverns and containers around the world. And that keeps crude prices soft. But how much is being stored? Consultant Andy Lipow says, we're not so sure.
In the U.S. and in Europe, inventory data is quite good. However, if one were to look at Asia or Africa or South America, there's a lot of missing pieces.
Also fuzzy, how much is in tanker ships? One estimate suggests it's at a 7-year high. But for even better data, some energy sleuths are counting tankers off of Singapore and Rotterdam, a kind of energy Where's Waldo. Jamie Webster at the Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy says storage will really matter when demand starts to outrun supply.
You know, if you suddenly don't have enough oil out there, knowing that that storage is available in lots of places in the world, that really helps with energy security.
And perhaps we'll keep prices from skyrocketing. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.